Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very excited to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking with a best-selling writer by the name of Firuzeh Dumas. And perhaps you are acquainted with her New York Times best-selling memoir, Funny in Farsi. Firuzeh Dumas was born in Abadan, Iran, but then grew up in California. And so her memoir kind of talks about that sometimes wrenching experience of trying to make a home for herself in a very brand new place, sometimes in the midst of bewildering experiences. And that is also certainly the experience of the central character in a new novel by Firuzeh Dumas called It Ain't So Awful, Falafel. And in this book, we meet a young girl who was born in Iran but finds herself in California trying to adapt to a very new place and a very new culture. And it just so happens that her family is making this transition just ahead of the dramatic events which occur in Iran with the fall of the Shah, the rise of the Ayatollah Khomeini, and of course the taking of those American hostages in the U.S. Embassy. It is not a good time to be an Iranian living in the United States. And that is part of this novel story as well. Again, it's called It Ain't So Awful, Falafel. It's published by Clarion Books, a division of Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And Firuzeh Dumas, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited about this. I am sorry that I have not read your memoir. I've certainly heard great things about it, and especially after reading this novel and enjoying it so much, I promise that I will read Funny in Farsi. I wonder if you
I'm going to hold you to that.
Okay, fine. I wonder if you could just say a word about to what extent this new novel, which, by the way, is written with somewhat younger readers in mind, although I really enjoyed it thoroughly, how much is this novel also closely tied to your own real life experiences? There are obviously certain ways in which it appears to parallel your story very closely. Tell us just how closely this novel parallels your own life story.
Well, to give you a short answer, very closely. Basically, what the main character goes through is pretty much exactly what I went through. The reason I chose to write it as a fiction is I wanted to make some composite characters, and because I was writing for a younger audience, I wanted to actually have fewer characters in the book. So I did take some liberty with, you know, making one person out of three in real life. But other than that, the experience that she goes through, the emotions she experiences, those were taken from my own life.
I have read and then interviewed the authors of several works intended for younger readers, and first of all, almost sort of to my bemusement, have really enjoyed these books and in no way felt like I was reading something intended for another kind of reader. I mean, I've found them just absolutely engrossing, riveting works. And I wonder for you, to what extent, and your book is similar. I wonder to what extent did you sort of consciously craft it as a work designed with a certain kind of reader, certain age of listener, of reader in mind?
Well, first of all, that is an excellent question, because It Ain't So Awful, Falafel took me 7 years to write. And a large part of that was figuring out, how do I write for a younger audience? Because I normally write adult nonfiction. Now, I should say something interesting. My first book, Funny in Farsi, was written for adults and is now used in junior highs and high schools and colleges all over the country. So I thought I was writing for adults, which, I mean, most of the readers are adults, but, I mean, I have a lot of fans in junior high with that book. So It Ain't So Awful, Falafel, I wrote it specifically for middle school, and 90% of the reviewers have said that I'm an adult, and I think this book is fine for adults. So clearly, I don't know what I'm talking about. But for me, writing for a younger audience, there were just two differences. One was I was writing historical fiction, and initially I had a lot more history in the book, and I kept thinking, you know, this feels more like a history book than actually a story. So it took me actually a couple years to figure out what the right amount of history would be for a work of historical fiction, because Iran-U.S. history is so rich, and it is so interesting. I mean, I could write a book just about that, but that's not what my intention was. So the amount of history that I put in the book, I thought was just the amount that a middle schooler would be interested in. And the other difference was the title. I picked a title that I thought a younger person would appreciate. So far so good, but we'll see. I mean, I still have, the book just came out a couple weeks ago, so I'm still, the verdict is still out.
Very good. I appreciate the fact that you said that you took so long to write this book and labored over it mightily, because I think a lot of people from the outside looking in make some really incorrect assumptions, probably even more so when it comes to, for instance, a children's book, which this is not. But when it comes to something like a children's book or a work intended for young readers, I suspect a lot of people assume that for an author who typically writes for adults, that this is almost like a day off or a walk in the park or something very, very simple. It sounds like you took this assignment very seriously, the responsibility, and that it was in no way an easy book for you to write.
Now, this was, without a doubt, the hardest project I've ever done. And, you know, 7 years, I mean, I wrote 26 versions of this book before I got it right. And there were just so many times when I thought, oh, dear God, you know, when is this going to end? And yet I couldn't quit, because when you start a creative project and your soul is in it, you can't quit. It's not an option. You know, it's like it's like being on a roller coaster and at one point saying, you know, I want to get off. Well, you can't get off because it's not done yet. So that's what it felt like to me. And I have to say, though, when it was done, I loved it. I absolutely loved it, and it took 7 years, but that's how long it took.
I wonder if you could just say a word about, maybe in a little more specific fashion, about the fact that this book really is very close to what you yourself experienced growing up in California in the 1970s, just ahead of the fall of the Shah and the taking of the hostages and so on. And it sounds like even specific things that you experienced, for good or for ill, are also part of this book. I wonder if you could just say a word about kind of the process by which you crafted this work of fiction, and how did you sort of decide what moments from your own life belonged in this book, and what other incidents needed to be, in a sense, created out of the blue. It's not so much that I want a list of the specific things that are or are not from your own life, but what was that process like, and what sort of criteria guided your choices?
So when I became an adult, when I look back at my life, I realized that I had been very fortunate in my life, because when I was 13 years old, the Iranian Revolution happened. I was living in California with my parents, and my father lost his job, and he was unemployed for a very long time. And, you know, I went through something extremely difficult. And the only reason I made it through was because I had a very caring community. I was surrounded by incredibly kind people who I need to add are still my friends. So I wanted to write about that period in my life, because when you're 13 years old and you go through something really difficult, you don't think it's ever going to end. And I, you know, at that age, I was going through something. You know, I was the only Iranian in my school. We didn't know any other Iranians where we lived, because this was before the revolution. This was before the immigration. So I was the only one I was the only person I knew of who had a father who could not find a job. And, you know, my father had been an engineer. He had been working with an American company that was building an oil refinery in Iran. But when the hostages were taken, U.S.-Iran ties were severed, and so he was out of a job. And, of course, nobody wanted to hire an Iranian engineer in America. So this was really devastating for me, me, because my father was somebody who had worked his entire life. He was very proud of being an engineer. And to see my father sitting at home on the sofa every single day was just gut-wrenching. I mean, it was absolutely gut-wrenching. So I wanted to write about that, because I knew that a lot of kids go through really difficult times. And unfortunately, I think there are many kids who relate to having unemployed parents today. But the important point of the book was that it was the kindness of the community that I lived in that helped me get through it. And I really am who I am today because of all the kindnesses that I experienced. So I wanted to write a book that had kindness as a theme. And one thing, you know, hasn't come up in this interview yet, but I want your readers to know, the books that I write are very funny. I mean, I'm a humorist. My first book was a runner-up for the Thurber Prize for American Humor. I lost to Jon Stewart. And this book, It Ain't So Awful Falafel, it's historical fiction, but it's very funny. So that is a surprising layer that most people don't expect when they're reading a book that has to do with a Middle Eastern character.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Firouze Dumas about her newest book, which is a novel called It Ain't So Awful Falafel, and you may recognize her name from her best-selling memoir, Funny in Farsi. Let's talk a moment about some of the specifics of your own life, and then we'll dig into a few layers of this wonderful new novel. So describe to our listeners exactly when you and your parents moved from Iran to California. And actually, ahead of that, tell us about what you remember about life in Iran. How old were you when your family made the move?
So when I was 7 years old, my father got a two-year assignment to come to Whittier, California, to help an American company build an oil refinery in Iran. So when I was 7 years old, we moved to Whittier, California, and my father had been a Fulbright scholar in America back in 1953. He'd spent a year at Texas A&M. And so I grew up with a father who was nonstop talking about America. My father loved America. I mean, he just would go on and on about, you know, how about the freeways, how there's such amazingly big freeways and there's really clear signage and the bathrooms are clean and there's anything you ever want to find, you could find it in America. And, you know, he was like, he could have been a spokesperson for all immigrants to America. So I, you know, even as a seven-year-old, it was very exciting for me to finally come and sort of see this promised land. And when we came in 1972, we landed in Whittier, California, where most people we encountered had never heard of Iran. And so it was very odd for us because we kept thinking, how can you have never heard of Iran? How is this possible? And, of course, because wherever you live, you think is a very important place. And, you know, people would ask us about camels, and we always wonder, why are you asking us about camels? You know, I'd only seen a camel once in a zoo. But nonetheless, those 2 years that we were in Whittier just always remained in our lives as two of the best years we've had because everybody was so incredibly welcoming and hospitable. And, you know, I kept in touch until she passed away with my second grade teacher, Mrs. Sandberg. She was at my wedding. I still keep in touch with my second grade crossing guard, Mrs. Popkin. It was just, you know, our America to us was not Richard Nixon, who was president, but it was all the regular folks that we met in our daily lives. And we moved back to Iran after 2 years. And I was very sad, mainly because I had not finished reading all the books in the kids section of the Whittier Public Library. But 2 years later, my father got another assignment. We came back to America. And this time we were here when the revolution happened. So we ended up staying. And that was the time period that I chose to write about in It Ain't So Awful, Falafel.
So this parallels your second time living here in the United States. Your father loved America and was excited about it. The mother in this novel finds it much more difficult, is not excited about the transition, is resistant to the notion of even attempting to learn English and so on. How much does that parallel your own mother's attitude about America?
Well, you know, my mother had a very tough time. And, you know, in all fairness to her, you know, my father came here for a job, so he had somewhere to go every single day. Whereas my mom, you know, was alone. She didn't speak the language. You know, I was off to school every day. So her life changed, honestly, for the worse. I mean, my dad and I sort of had this exciting changes in our life. But my mom went from having her relatives and her friends in a country where she knew everything to moving to a country where she literally did not know a single person and did not know the language. And, you know, she used to watch television to learn English. And, you know, she loved all the game shows. And so, you know, she'd watch Let's Make a Deal. And even though she didn't know how to speak English, like, she knew the prices of everything. You know, she'd go, coffee maker, $12.99. So, you know, she managed to sort of find her place. And then once the revolution happened, there were a lot of Iranians that came over to California. And that helped her quite a bit. I mean, now, you know, if you're ever in California, there are parts of California that you can't believe that you're not in Tehran. I mean, there's all kinds of Persian food, and there's Persian supermarkets, and it's quite amazing, especially for us, because we were here when those things did not exist.
And you were essentially the only Iranians you knew about in your community.
In fact, the 2 years that we were in America the first time, we ran into another Iranian one time in the 2 years, and of course it was at a mall, because if you want to see animals, you go in the zoo. If you want to see Iranians, you go to the mall. So we actually heard people speaking Persian, and it was shocking to us. And we went up to them, and we said, are you Iranian? And they said, yes. And we said, what are you doing here? And they were actually just traveling, but we invited them to our house the following weekend. And, you know, we were just amazed that, you know, I keep saying it was like, you know, two polar bears running into each other in Hawaii or something. It was amazing.
One really poignant moment, this comes from the very first chapter of the book, kind of touches on the matter of your mother not learning English. It is when your main character's father is asking the daughter to read something to the mother and translate it for her, and he's kind of saying something about how she has not learned very much English. She was always encouraged to try, but her reply was some kind of statement that I think is so poignant. Do you remember what this moment is?
Yeah. As Mango Zesh said, it's too late for me.
I think that's that really touches on something that it was one thing for you. I mean, certainly as a young person, certainly this move to the United States and transitioning to a new school and trying to make friends, it's not like any of that was particularly easy. Some of it was tremendously difficult and painful. But I don't think a lot of us stop to think about what it's like when someone is middle-aged or older. And and it is so much more daunting to think about something like undertaking a brand new, completely unfamiliar language.
Well, you know, one thing I realized later is that when you are a grown-up and you are trying to learn another language in a country, you don't want to make mistakes, because we're afraid that if we make a mistake, we sound stupid. Whereas when you're a kid and you're learning a language, you know, you don't think that much. You just do your best, and eventually you learn. And so it's really hard for a middle-aged person to go to another country and to learn the language, because you have to let go of that expectation you have of being able to speak the language well, because for a long time you can't speak it well.
Right.
And that's a huge obstacle.
And particularly if there are the chuckles of strangers that might not even be meant as derisively as it might feel when you're the person, in a sense, being laughed at. I mean, we can sort of imagine how difficult that kind of a moment is. Early in the novel, yes.
No, I'm just going to say that I have a lot of empathy for foreigners, because you're always feeling a little less than, because you can't speak the language. And and you know, I'm an Iranian raised in America. I'm married to a Frenchman. I currently live in Germany. So my life has been a series of having to learn languages. And it's, you know, it's hard. I mean, it's, you know, sometimes I think in America people look at others who don't speak English as somehow, well, what's wrong with you? But if you've ever been in that position and you have to go to another country and learn the language, you do have just a lot more empathy.
One of the things that the parents in your novel do quite a lot of is really worry terribly about all kinds of things that might befall them, and especially might befall their daughter. And some of what seems to worry them are sort of comically exaggerated. I mean, worrying about things that couldn't possibly happen, although I wish I could find some of the really kind of amusing examples of that. And then, of course, in other cases, it's understandable that they Yeah, I mean, like one of them says, you should never play with cats, only look at them from a distance. They might scratch your eyeballs out. And you should never let dogs lick you because you can get one of those diseases that comes from being licked by dogs. Is this something you lived with your own parents, yes, worrying to that extent?
They did. I'm sorry, you said they were exaggerations. I'm afraid these were not exaggerations. See, when this is a cultural thing, but when I grew up in Iran, people did not have pets in their houses. And when we came to America, one of the cultural shocks we had was that you go in someone's house and they have like two dogs and four cats, and they're all over the house. And in Iran, like if you had a dog, it was a guard dog, it was outside. And this sense of, I had a lot of friends growing up where the animals kind of overran the house. I mean, they were all over the place. And this was really new for us. I mean, we never really thought of, I had actually never thought of cats and dogs as something that you have like on your sofa or in your bed or, you know, it was very odd for us. And my father had a really hard time with it because, you know, he would always warn me. He was like, you know, listen, don't try to play with cats because I know people who are blind now because the cats scratched out their eyeballs. And he always had stories like that. And I'd say, like, who does this happen to? And he'd get all flustered and he'd say, I don't remember the name, but it was someone I knew. And of course, you know, when you're a kid, you can tell when your parents are lying to you. So I'd, you know, egg him on. I'd say, well, who was it? Try to think of the name. Mm-hmm. And he'd say, you know, it's not important. It doesn't matter who it was. It was like someone's neighbor I knew, but. And he always had a warning, and I remember, like, when I wanted to go to camp at one point on Catalina Island, which is off of California, and, you know, my father, you know, said, is there horseback riding? And I said, no, there isn't. He said, well, thank God, because I knew someone who got kicked by a horse and they went blind. So, yeah, there was definitely my parents on an anxiety scale of 1 to 10 were, like, 12 and a half.
Right. Well, of course, there was plenty to be genuinely or authentically worried about, given all that they had experienced, and then of course all of that ratcheted up quite a lot. I mean, there was an increasingly long list of things to worry about as life became much more difficult.
Of course. But once the revolution came, then it was like they were in this pit of anxiety that was never ending. But you know, the irony is, my parents never worried about the things that actually American parents were worried about, like drugs or alcohol or any of that stuff. Like, because they were so removed from American culture, they didn't know that stuff went on in schools.
Right.
So I just always found it ironic that the stuff they worried about, you know, American parents never ever thought about.
Right. I really appreciate that in this work of fiction that I can really imagine a young person enjoying and being entertained by. There are also these ways in which almost slyly you sort of help us understand how different life is in a place like Iran, especially back in the 1970s, versus life here. I want to read a moment from the book that touches on this, and feel free to comment then. And this kind of gets us back to the matter of cats and dogs and all of the worries that your parents had. You write... and then this is the central character, of course, as our narrator. The first time we went into an American supermarket in Compton, that's where you had used to live, we were going up and down the aisles, and all of a sudden, whoa, a whole aisle of food for cats and dogs. In Iran, most cats and dogs live on the streets, and they're lucky if someone throws a scrap at them now and then. Most of the time, they're on their own. In America, there's dog food for young dogs, old dogs, fat dogs, small dogs, active dogs, and lazy dogs. And cats have choices like salmon, beef, or chicken-flavored meals. I always thought cats would eat any food. Then I saw the cat food commercials on TV that show cats that are insulted when they're served food that isn't moist enough. You see the cat turning around and walking away, tail in the air, disgusted. Meanwhile, the owner is going nuts because of his pouting cat, so he buys the juicy and delicious chicken liver cat food in the can that he should have bought in the first place instead of the cheaper dry cat food. The animal is finally happy, and the owner breathes a sigh of relief. I have never seen a cat in Iran walk away from food. Even if their meal is not their first choice, they eat it because who knows when the next meal will come. Plus, if they don't eat their food, some other cat will for sure. My dad says that the dogs and cats in America are luckier than most people in the world.
That's true.
I love that passage. And right. I mean, that's part of what part of what it makes it important is not just that it's to some extent amusing, but also it is very, very true. And it's one of those things that we just don't think about, this aspect of American life and how what a sharp contrast it is with life in most of the rest of the world.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I try, you know, with my writing, with all three of my books, actually, I try to inject as much culture as I can, because I like to think that all my books are educational. But, you know, because I'm a humorist, I try to weave in stories. I'm not trying to teach. I'm not trying to preach. But I'm just trying to show what life was like in Iran and what it's like, and what it was like in America. And, you know, just these little simple stories, people do learn a lot. And actually, you come to appreciate where you live, because it's very easy to take things for granted. And sometimes you just have to see the contrast. And then you realize, wow, you know what, I'm pretty darn lucky.
Mm. We're speaking with Firuzeh Duma about her book, It Ain't So Awful, Falafel. It's a novel intended for young readers that very closely parallels her own real-life experiences of when she and her family moved from Iran to the United States, actually twice. The events of this novel parallel the events from that second stint in America, which actually unhappily turned out to coincide with the fall of the Shah of Iran, the rise of the Ayatollah Khomeini, and, of course, the taking of the American hostages, which made life for this Iranian family in America much, much more difficult. Would you please pronounce the given name of the central character of this novel?
Her name is Zomorod Yousefzadeh.
One more time.
You know, my name before I got married was Firuzeh Jazayiri.
Oh, okay.
So you can see where the inspiration came from.
Right. I just said similarly impenetrable.
Absolutely. And I remember as a seven-year-old, one of the first lessons I learned was that my name did not fit on any forms in America. And when I got my library card from the Whittier Public Library, you know, my name, I tried to write as small as I could, and still half of my name just sort of, you know, went over like a waterfall. And this was one of the banes of having a name with, you know, 16 letters in it. So I want to make sure the character in the book suffered equally as I had.
Right. So this central character sort of christens herself with an American name to avoid this embarrassment. And she chooses the name of Cindy, the youngest daughter on television's The Brady Bunch. Did you do something similar?
Oh, I did.
That name or a different name?
No, actually, the name I picked was Julie.
In the novel, Cindy meets another girl named Cindy, and I think you end up calling her in the novel Original Cindy, because
right.
She was already Cindy, and you and your character had just sort of adapted the name of Cindy. I think what's really interesting, too, is the way in which the parents in this book will not quite pronounce the names of other people correctly, that David will be Davud and things like that. Is that something you remember from your own parents and their struggles?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when my parents came to America and, you know, they would meet my friends, my father especially had a really hard time with the names. And he'd say to me, I think all your friends' names sound alike. And I'd say, no, they're not. You know, I had Kristen and Christine and Catherine. And to my father, like, all those names sounded pretty much the same. Hmm. And it is funny because when my husband and I moved to Germany a few years ago, and I get names confused here so much, and I think very often about my parents and what they went through, and I just think, you know, that karma train came right around. You know, I used to make fun of my parents for having a hard time, and here I am now struggling with names and language myself. So I have paid, my punishment has found me.
One of the really interesting challenges for young Cindy, particularly when it comes to her mother, is that it falls on her shoulders to do most of the translating. And not only for, in a sense, life's necessities, but also certain moments when it falls on her to try to convey sort of the meaning or the essence of something, particularly when they are watching maybe a comedy show on television, and it falls to little Cindy to try to explain to her mother why something is funny. Do you have recollections of that same kind of experience and that sharp challenge?
Absolutely. That was taken straight out of our life. When we came to America in 1972, we did what probably every other American family was doing at the time, which is we'd sit down in the evening and watch all the comedies. And, of course, there was the Carol Burnett show and the Flip Wilson show and, you know, Laughing and all these really shows that to this day I love watching. And, of course, the humor was very different. Something would happen, and my parents would say, Fuse, why is that funny? And, you know, they felt that because I was in an American school, I had somehow mastered American humor. And I certainly didn't know everything, but, I had the gift of gab. So I try to explain, well, this is because, a turkey is considered a very funny animal here. So when he calls him a turkey, that's funny. And, the one thing, though, that I could never explain was why it was funny if somebody threw a pie in someone's face, because we didn't think that was funny at all. And we'd always just kind of be horrified and think, what a waste of a pie. Why would you throw it in someone's face? You know, they should be eating the pie.
Right.
So that, I still don't think that's funny.
One of the examples of...
Thing,
go ahead.
Our favorite thing, though, I got to say, and this is, some of your older listeners might remember this. There was a wonderful show called The Flip Wilson Show, and at some point, Flip Wilson, who was this hilarious African-American comedian, would become Geraldine, this woman. And that was, we didn't even understand what he was saying when he was dressed up as Geraldine, but we just thought he was so funny. That always had the three of us laughing, and we never even knew why.
And it sounds like most of the time your mother found very little to laugh about. You tell the story in the novel of going to a swimming pool once where there was this famous sign, "We don't swim in your toilet. Please don't pee in our pool." Cindy says, "I translated the sign for my mom, and she said it was rude to have a sign with the word pee on it. I told her that's what made it funny. She insisted it was not funny at all." That's the hard part about translating. Saying what words mean is easy, but trying to make my mom understand why something is funny is much harder. Getting my mom to laugh in America is nearly impossible. Your character of Cindy in the initially struggles to make good friends, and the first person she meets who turns out to really be a genuine friend is a schoolmate named Carolyn, and Carolyn happens to be from Norway, and we have a sense that that's maybe one reason why she is as friendly and welcoming to Cindy as she is. Again, does this parallel any kind of a real life experience for you?
Well, the Carolyn character, when she says to Cindy she's from Norway, what she means is that her ancestors are from Norway, and she thought that when Cindy said she was from Iran, that's what she was referring to.
Oh, I misunderstood that. Okay.
Oh, no, that's okay. That's okay. And now, in real life, the Carolyn character is named after my friend, Carolyn, with whom I'm still good friends with. And, in fact, I met Carolyn back when I was in sixth grade, and she told me soon after that she wanted to be a journalist. And she was the only kid I ever knew who asked me questions about Iran. And she went on to become an anchor woman and has won Emmys and is currently on television. It's Carolyn Johnson. She's in the Los Angeles area as an anchor woman. So I always remind her that I feel that her Emmy, she really owes it to my family, because we were the first people she constantly interviewed. But she was an absolutely glorious friend. And there's I'm very proud that she's one of the main characters in the book.
Mm. And she turns out to be a very helpful friend to Cindy and her family as they make their way through all kinds of different experiences. One of my favorite moments is when the character of Cindy talks about going to drama class twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
"We read plays, which are basically books written as if people are talking. It's my first time ever reading plays, and I love it. It feels like I'm an invisible visitor in someone's life." Is that how you felt at that age?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I thought it was magical. I mean, first of all, I was a bookworm. I still am. But my God, the first time you ever read a play, I thought, oh my God, whoever thought of this? This is just magical.
And of course, one of the one of the very first play that the character of Cindy reads is Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire, with a certain line that very powerfully resonates with her.
Yep, I always depend on the kindness of strangers. I read that, and I remember, you know, as a 12-year-old, I wrote it on a piece of paper, and I taped it to my wall.
Hmm. And, of course, that's something that you lived out again and again. I think one thing that is interesting in the novel, and maybe you can give a few specific examples of this, is that the character of Cindy and her parents encounter a fair amount of kindness. In fact, maybe more kindness than we might expect. Maybe nowadays versus back then, I don't know. But they are the recipients of some kindness, shown some kindness, but often those attempts at kindness don't go perfectly well or are not perfectly understood, and certain invitations, in a sense, might sort of fall flat because, you know, like your dad's never played golf or whatever it might be. But I really found that really interesting to sort of read about these attempts at friendship, these attempts at connection that from really both sides will sometimes be very difficult to sort of complete or consummate.
Well, you know, somebody, a reviewer, recently said that the part that they felt didn't resonate true to them was that people were so kind to our family. And the reviewer said, this doesn't like seem like something that's true. And that made me really sad because actually it is true. And we, you know, part of the reason I wanted to write this book is I wanted to remind people how powerful kindness is and how much we actually have an opportunity to change our surroundings based on how we treat the people in our community. And I mean, granted, you know, when we came to America, we were the only Iranian family. So, you know, we didn't come, you know, in a massive migration, which tends to always bring with it a lot of negative feelings from the natives, so to speak. But there were so many kindnesses, and even the attempts at connecting, you know, like somebody inviting my dad to play golf, which, you know, my dad, of course, had no clue how to play golf. But, you know, we could still appreciate, wow, this was a really nice invitation. But you know, it was still, it meant a lot to us. I mean, granted, you know, a lot of the stuff, you know, there was a misconnection. And one of the things I always remember is my mother insisted on making Persian food for people, you know, neighbors and such. And I knew enough about Americans to know that they didn't like eating foods that were really different. And, you know, this was in the 1970s. Right now, there's a lot of ethnic food in California. But, you know, at that time, you know, giving somebody a plate of Persian food was beyond exotic. Like, I knew most people wouldn't try it.
Right. I remember one specific example where your mother prepared something for a neighbor, and apparently it looked like mud.
Right. For any of the listeners out there who are familiar with Persian food, we have an absolutely divine food called fesenjun, which unfortunately looks exactly like mud. But it is absolutely divine, and if you ever have an opportunity to taste it, you should.
you should just close your eyes.
Give it to someone. Unfortunately, it doesn't look as appetizing as one would hope it would.
Right. And there's also this practice that comes up kind of again and again, apparently a sort of attitude or cultural understanding in Iran. Is it tarof or something like that?
Tarof, right.
Explain what that is and how that could sometimes maybe be misunderstood or misinterpreted.
Concept that's difficult to explain to Americans because it just doesn't exist in the American culture, and there's certainly no one word to explain it. But, you know, there's many examples of it. For instance, if you were to come to my house pretty much at any time of the day, and, it, you know, if I were being a traditional Iranian, I would say, Greg, please come and eat with us. And you would say, oh, no, I just ate. I'd say, oh, no, but please come. Just have a little bit. And you'd say, no, I can't because I'm stuffed. And I'd say, oh, please, but I made somebody eat something. It's especially for you. Please come. And this could just go on for 20 minutes.
Hmm.
And so it's this sort of extreme hospitality. And the problem with tarof, and this is what makes it confusing, even for Iranians, sometimes it's hard to tell when people are being sincere. And my father used to come home from the office sometimes, and he'd say to my mom, okay, I have three people coming for dinner tonight. And my mom would say, well, why did you invite three people for dinner tonight? I didn't know about this. And he'd say, well, I asked them and they accepted, because, of course, you don't have tarof in America.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he had sort of insincerely invited someone, and since that person was American and didn't know Tarof, you know, they would accept. So we had just a lot of awkwardness with this, and it's one of those I personally do not like Tarof. I prefer just 100% sincerity, but there's also a loveliness to it, and it is, you know, we could probably do an entire show on it, Greg. It's not something I can explain in just a few minutes.
Right. So, of course, this time you lived in America the second time around coincides with the dramatic fall of the Shah and the rise of the Ayatollah Khomeini and so on. Just how difficult was that for you and your family? And what was it like to relive that?
It was very difficult because when we came to America, most Americans had never heard of Iran. And because of the hostage taking back in 1979, all of a sudden, Iran was in the news every single day, and many, many Americans just decided they hated all Iranians. And, you know, I was 13 years old when this was going on, and I could not understand how people could hate an entire country because of what a group of people were doing. And, you know, people would often say to us, what do you guys think of the hostage situation? And we just found that to be the most bewildering question because we think, well, what do you think we think? It's horrible. And the thought that people would even think that somehow Iranians, just because a group of Iranians did this means that all Iranians are happy about it, I mean, to us that was just unbelievable. And it was really difficult to watch this kind of hatred that just grew day by day by day because the hostages were held for 444 days. And that's a very, very long time. And it was, you know, every single day on the news, you know, there was a countdown and, you know, it just got to the point where I felt like for 444 days, we just held our breath.
Mm.
And, you know, nobody was praying harder for their release than we were.
Right.
And yet, at the same time, to be hated for being Iranian, we thought, why are you hating us? You know, the hostages are not in our garage. It was bewildering.
Mm. And, of course, probably made still more bewildering by that language barrier, which made it even harder to offer clarification. And of course, also what made it harder was that your father lost his job, or I assume he did the way
right.
that the father does in this novel. Talk for a moment about just how wrenching that was.
Well, when the hostages were taken, the U.S.-Iran ties were severed. And one of the reasons I wanted to write about the history of that period is that it's still affecting the U.S.-Iran relations today. So it's really important to know the history of that period. But my father lost his job, and here was this man who had been an engineer his entire life. He was very accomplished. He was very good at his job. But he was an Iranian citizen living in America with a long Persian name and a Persian accent. And, I mean, that was like nuclear waste. You know, no one wanted to touch it. And my dad kept sending out resumes, and, you know, we'd be in the kitchen table with the typewriter, you know, writing resumes and cover letters, and every time, you know, we put it in the mailbox, and I mean, I would say a little prayer every time, like, oh, please, please, God, just, you know, and it was wrenching because he didn't find a job, and he was unemployed for like a year and a half, and we'd run out of money, and we never thought in a million years that we would ever be in that situation. Like, we went overnight from being this just average middle class family to being people who had a certain amount of savings that was running out really quickly.
Mm.
And it was, you know, it's something, unfortunately, a lot of Americans can relate to today, but we just never thought we'd ever be in that position. And as a kid, what I saw was that my father's dignity disappeared, that he, you know, he was somebody who had worked his entire life, and we need to work, you know. To have a job, to have a place to go to every day, that gives you a sense of purpose. I mean, that gives you a sense of worth. And to have that taken away from you, it's just emotionally wrenching.
Mm. One of the things that the character of Cindy does as soon as this happens, as soon as her father loses his job, is that she announces that she wants to sell the beautiful furniture that is in her bedroom, the furniture that she herself picked out. And eventually she gets a job and hands over her very first paycheck for $49 to her father, who at first is very reluctant to even accept it from her. Are you drawing from your own personal reaction to your own father's firing?
Mm-hmm. That was actually, that part was 100% true.
Wow. I mean, I think that says a lot about who you were, that in that kind of a moment you could think about the good of your family and were so sensitive to what the family needed versus your own comforts.
Well, you know what? And I think a lot of kids are that way. I don't think I was unique in that. I think a lot of kids very acutely feel their parents' pain and wish they could do something about it.
Hmm. Ultimately, how did your family sustain itself through this ordeal and emerge to the other side intact?
Well, eventually, once the hostages were released, my father ended up finding a job, but not in California. He ended up moving to Texas for a while. And my mom and I, in real life, I have two brothers. With one of my brothers, stayed in California so that I wouldn't have to change schools again. So, you know, my father had a, you know, patchwork series of jobs. And, you know, my father today is 92 years old, so he retired a while ago. But he never, you know, my father never had a job like he'd had before the revolution. You know, he accepted jobs that were far, far lower in position and in pay than what he had had before. But he was very grateful for that even. You know, it's better than being unemployed. But, you know, he never, the trajectory of his career, I mean, they just veered way off path once U.S.-Iran ties were severed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my father, and I'm very blessed to have this, is a very optimistic man. He's a very positive human being. And he just had nothing but gratitude for his life. You know, he'd always say, you know, there's so many people who have it so much worse than we do. And, you know, it was, I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that I had that as a role model.
Hmm. As we get towards the end of the book, I want you to talk about a really poignant moment or interesting moment, an exchange between Cindy and Carolyn. This is when life is very, very stressful. And she is feeling such mixed emotions, such mixed feelings about her good friend. At one point she says, a part of me hates Carolyn at this moment. A part of me thinks she is the best friend I have ever had. I mean, this is at a point when the family is running out of money and she doesn't have the heart to say something. And she finds this friendship to be in this really sort of precarious state. And I really appreciate that moment of honesty because that we can really understand how such a thing could happen. And I feel like that's one moment that really makes this ordeal come alive in a very vivid way.
Well, you know, one thing I got to say, when I was writing It Ain't So Awful Falafel, and even though I knew from the beginning I was writing this for middle school or early high school, I realized that my voice is going to be the same because what resonates with readers is authenticity. So whether or not I'm writing adult nonfiction or tween fiction, that authenticity has to be there. And I don't care if you're 9 or 99, that's what resonates. So, you know, in a way, It Ain't So Awful Falafel is just as real as my other books. It's just that parts of it are fiction.
Right. And I appreciate those moments that ring so true. And, of course, we appreciate how your family came through all of that difficulty so well. And we appreciate how the fact that although certain people turned towards you with new suspicion and even hatred, that there were also those Americans who continued to extend kindness to you and your family. And
oh,
that's a really important part of the story as well. It Ain't So Awful Falafel, and Firuzeh Duma, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you so much, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Firuzeh Duma has a website, which is hername.com. So FIROOZEHDUMAS.com. Again, Firuzeh Duma.com, FIROOZEHDUMAS.com. At this website, among other things, educators will find all kinds of materials and resources with which you can utilize this book for your classes, for a study of intercultural relations and this event with the hostage crisis in Iran and so on. My thanks to Fivrezay Dumas for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about her remarkable novel, It Ain't So Awful, Falafel. Tomorrow, gardening expert